Okay. Next case is number 05-5173, Citizens Federal Bank against the United States. Mr. Ryan.
May it please the court. The trial court's decision should be reversed. The trial court expressly stated that whether Citizens was entitled to recover damages for its exchange of sub-debt for preferred stock, quote, depends on the standard used to determine if there was a causal link between the breach and the exchange. The trial court then proceeded to apply the, in its words, less stringent substantial factor test. Since that time, this court has made clear that the less stringent substantial factor test is not the correct test of causation. Rather, the correct test of causation, as explained in the CalFed case, is the traditional proximate cause standard of causation, under which you cannot recover unless you have shown that the losses would have been incurred in the absence of the breach, or would not have been incurred in the absence of the breach, and you have shown that the losses stem directly from the breach.
Well, isn't the real question
inevitably
how specific,
and naturally, right?
Correct, under Meyer.
Isn't the real question how specific the intention must be? That is it enough to say that, well, when they said you could no longer use this particular kind of, this particular item as part of your capital, you knew they were going to have to do something to correct it, or did you also have to say, and we anticipate that the way they will correct it is to substitute the preferred stock for the debt?
Well, it all depends on the evidence in the particular case. You need to show, above all other things, you need to show that the action that you took you would not have taken in the absence of the breach. And the reason for that is, if you don't apply that standard, you're going to put the non-breaching party in a position better than the one it would have occupied if there had been no breach. For example, in this case, the plaintiffs repeatedly stated to the trial court in their briefs, and their witnesses stated in depositions, that they would have undertaken this exchange even in the absence of the breach, because the sub-debt was eliminated from two of the three regulatory capital requirements by what was undisputedly a non-breaching provision of FIREA. They told the plaintiffs told the court, and their witnesses specifically said they would have taken this action even in the absence of the breach. And it could
be. They said to the trial court that they would have done this even though in the statute Congress had not barred the use of this regulatory capital? Do they say that?
They said specifically, yes, that they would have done it even in the absence of the breach. That is, even
well,
in
I'm
the absence of
the breach. Even in the absence of the breach. I want to find. Did they ever explicitly say that even if Congress had not precluded the use of regulatory capital, nevertheless, we would have done what we did?
Well, they said that they would have done it even if Congress didn't exclude from regulatory capital the goodwill and the capital credit. Of course, the reason that they said they did it was that in the same statute, in FIREA, Congress and subsequently the OTS excluded from regulatory capital sub-debt. So a part of FIREA that everyone agrees did not dispute the breach the contract was the reason, according to the plaintiffs, that they engaged in the exchange. Because FIREA did two things. One was a breach, one was not a breach.
Well, let me put it this way. Suppose what Congress had done in the statute was to permit the use as regulatory capital of this, I don't know what to call the stuff they do, but it said, didn't touch that. It didn't touch the use of the goodwill, but it did say that you could not use subordinated debt. Suppose that's all Congress had done. Did they say that in that situation they still would have done what they did?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. And that's specifically the situation that they addressed. If Congress had left the goodwill alone, and if Congress had left the capital credit alone, they still would have engaged in the exchange, they said, because sub-debt no
longer. But my hypothetical is that Congress didn't leave both of them alone. Suppose Congress had said you can continue to use as regulatory capital this goodwill, but you cannot use as regulatory capital the subordinated debt.
Correct. I'm sorry.
Did they say that even if that's what Congress had done, they would still have made the exchange?
Yes, they did. And the reason they said they did was if Congress had left the goodwill alone but had excluded from regulatory capital the sub-debt, they would have undertaken the exchange because they didn't want to keep the sub-debt on their books if it didn't count as regulatory capital because it had such a high cost. That's specifically what they said in their briefs to the trial court. So they addressed that very specific situation. And their witnesses specifically addressed the issue too. Mr. Stusen, CEO, was asked, was the reason for this exchange offer the limitations that FIREA put on the subordinated capital? And he answered, yes, sir. That's at A400391 of the appendix. He also specifically stated, we did not replace the goodwill. So that is the testimony that was presented by Citizens CEO. And the plaintiffs pointed to that testimony and said that we did not engage in the exchange because of the goodwill provisions. We engaged in the exchange because of the subordinated debt provisions. Nonetheless, because the trial court applied the wrong standard...
Didn't the trial court still ultimately get to the right judgment, but for the breach... they wouldn't have changed the sub-debt for preferred stock, right?
No. They said exactly the opposite. But for the breach, because of the sub-debt provision...
The evidence showed... they really only had two choices. They either shrink or exchange. And they took one of those two courses as a result of the breach. Now, I understand the CalFed problem, but... Why doesn't the record still show that the breach was the cause of what occurred?
Because they didn't have only two choices. Because of the sub-debt provision, they engaged in the exchange. After that, they were not only fully capitalized with regard to the existing capital standards, they met the fully phased-in capital requirements.
You're saying that after FIREA, they were nonetheless fully capitalized and not in violation?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's an undisputed fact. After FIREA, at the time, immediately upon FIREA's enactment and...
But they wouldn't be, wouldn't they fall out of compliance in a few years? If they hadn't done anything, sooner or later they would have been out of compliance, wouldn't they?
If they hadn't done anything and their assets stayed exactly the same...
No, if they had not done what they did, let's assume they just went about, kept going on, and you say... they were in compliance, but at some point when they had to phase this stuff out, they would be out of compliance, wouldn't they?
Yes, 4 years later, they wouldn't be out of compliance. They would not have complied with the top standard.
But
they had 5 years to do it.
They had 5 years to do it.
So your answer to my question really was not an appropriate answer, appreciating that the FIREA did permit a phasing out of the goodwill. Accounting.
I want to be as specific as possible, Your Honor. At the time FIREA was enacted...
At midnight of that day, before any phasing out of goodwill was obligated, you're saying they were in compliance.
They were in compliance, and they were in compliance with they were only out of compliance with the capital requirements that were going to exist in 5 years.
But so that applied to everybody.
I'm sorry?
And that applied to everybody.
That did apply to everybody. And so
that's a very strange argument then to say it at midnight before all of these changes are made that FIREA made, the change in the capital requirement, the core capital, the goodwill accounting, the various procedures which were eliminated in FIREA. You're saying that at the stroke of midnight plus 1 second, they hadn't yet come into effect, so they were in compliance.
No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, even after FIREA was enacted and implemented, months after FIREA was enacted and implemented, 2 years after FIREA was enacted and implemented, Citizens would have been fully in capital compliance.
But they had to either shrink or or recapitalize somehow quickly, that the time limit was approaching. They had to do something. Why doesn't the record show that regardless of whether we're looking at the substantial contribution or the inevitably standard, the record, why doesn't the record adequately support that they were, because of the breach, required to take the actions they did?
Because they didn't have to shrink or raise capital.
Well, you say they didn't have to, but eventually they'd have to do something, wouldn't they?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because Citizens was a profitable thrift. If they just kept making their profits that they were making before the breach, and they kept making that amount of profits for the next 3 or 4 years, they would have made up the $34 million gap in fully phased-in capital requirements. So they didn't have to shrink. They didn't have to raise capital. They elected to...
But wasn't the prudent thing for management to do not to gamble that everything would work out exactly as they had hoped, and to protect their depositors and their business by trying to correct the situation?
Sure, we're not challenging the prudence of what they
did.
Well,
and isn't it fair to say that it could be anticipated that as a prudent, successful management, they would do these things?
Yes, that's we can accept that fact, that this may have been a prudent thing to do. But the question still is, was it caused by the breach, or was it caused by the non-breaching provision of FIREA? And they told us the answer to that question. That's why the court explained in its opinion that application of the test in this case, whether it's the substantial factor test or the traditional Meyerly test reaffirmed in Calfed, is so important, because the plaintiffs told the court, and their witnesses told the court, that they would have taken this action even in the absence of the breach. That means they would have incurred the same exact costs in the absence of the breach. So to award them damages for this action is to place them in a position better than the one they would have occupied in the absence of the breach. But even under the substantial factor test, the court never explained why, because they would have taken this action in the absence of the breach, the substantial factor test was met. This court has explained in the Abbott Laboratories v. Brennan opinion, quoting Crosser and Keaton on torts, no case has been found where the defendant's act could be called a substantial factor when the event would have occurred without it. And so even under the substantial factor test, because the plaintiffs admitted and their witnesses admitted they would have taken the very same action in the absence of the breach, damages were inappropriate.
They do point out, I'm reading from the opinion, Citizens' chairman testified they didn't replace the lost goodwill through the exchange offer. He has attested that the exchange offer was done to recover FIREA's impact because it was so punitive. Why isn't that the connection?
Because he also said something very much more specific than that. He was asked, was the reason for this exchange offer the limitations that FIREA put on the subordinated capital? He was specifically asked, did you do this because of the sub-debt phase-out provision? And he answered, yes, sir.
But does that refute the finding that it could have been anticipated that they would do that?
Well, that does not refute the finding of anticipation, which relates to foreseeability. But the question here is causation. Foreseeability asks, could it be foreseen at the time of contracting whether this would have occurred? And of course, we have arguments on foreseeability because it couldn't have been foreseen that that adverse tax consequences would have resulted. But that's a separate argument. The foreseeability inquiry is, could this have been foreseen at the time of contracting whether this would have happened? The causation inquiry looks at what actually did happen and asks, did the breach, whether it was foreseeable or not, did the breach actually cause this? And Citizens told the court, plaintiffs told the court, and their witnesses told us in their positions, no, a non-breaching provision of FIREA caused us to do this.
Okay, now Mr. Ryan, we're on to your rebuttal time. Do you want to say what's left?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Thompson.
May it please the court, David Thompson for Citizens Federal. In this case, it's undisputed that Citizens lost $118 million of supervisory capital because of the breach.
It's also undisputed they had $169 million of non-contractual capital floating around out there that they had to deal with. Which one of them were they trying to deal with when they recapitalized?
Well, Your Honor, that is the question.
That is the question. And the trial court ducks it by saying, I don't really have to resolve that because the FIREA problem was a substantial factor, at least.
Right,
but that isn't the right test, we now know.
Well, a couple of things in that, if I might respond. First of all, as to whether the substantial factor test is the appropriate test, Chief Judge Damage looked to the trial court decision in Southern California, and he found Judge Beskier's decision there to be persuasive, and he cited it, he quoted it, he followed it. That decision was affirmed by this court after the CalFed decision, and the panel in SoCal specifically cited that substantial factor was the test and followed and affirmed.
I understand so that, but we still have to follow the language of CalFed,
I totally agree.
Resolves the issue.
Well, I think it's the one other point I would make is in Indiana, Michigan, and Power Company, also post-CalFed, the panel again said that the test is substantial factor. If you can show substantial factor, that's sufficient to satisfy.
Said that?
Yes, in Indiana, Michigan, and Power Company, and that was Judge Mayo writing, and the pin site for that is 422 F3rd. At 1373.
And did we say in that case that a substantial factor is the test?
Yes, Your Honor. It was cursory. It just was laying out there are three things you need to show in order to prove expectancy damage, foreseeability, reasonable certainty of damage, and a substantial factor for causation. And Judge Newman's decision in Abbott Laboratories that my friend Mr. Ryan cited to is actually very instructive, and we really encourage the court to look at it because the passage that Mr. Ryan cited to from Prosser and Keaton supports our view. There what Prosser and Keaton was saying and the court was saying is that substantial factor and but-for causation, which is what CalFed said was required, are really one and the same. If a factor is substantial, then it will be the but-for cause. And the court was making the point that you don't see that they generally yield the identical result. And the other point I would make about...
The problem we have here is that Judge Damage says, because many factors have combined, the defendant's breach, he makes it very clear that the test that he's using is important. He says the answer to this legal question depends on the standard used to determine if there was a causal link between the breach and the exchange. He's saying the case turns on this point, and then he goes on to say, I'm going to use the substantial.
Yes, and let me give you the context in which he was saying that. The government was arguing below two things. First of all, they said, and I quote, the causes of the exchange are multiple, close quote. And then they said, and the legal test is sole causation. And therefore they said, since the causes are multiple, and since it's a sole causation test, Citizens doesn't get summary judgment. And Chief Judge Damage said, sole causation is not the test, and CalFed affirmed that. CalFed agreed that multiple causation does not destroy causation and that sole causation was rejected in CalFed. And so, and the reason that Chief Judge Damage, he started from the premise that there are multiple causes of the exchange because that was the position the government was taking. When the government came to rest on this issue, they made the point, and this is in the joint appendix at 400253, but they made the point that the causes of the exchange are multiple. And he started from that premise and said, causation is not destroyed by multiplicity of causations. And the case that most carefully shows why this decision was correct and why Chief Judge Damage should be affirmed is Home Savings of America. There it was very similar, where Home Savings took two big hits, multiple hits to its capital from FIREA. The breach took away its supervisory capital, and the non-breaching provisions took away capital that it had no contractual right to. And just like Citizens, Home Savings raised capital and they shrank. They did both. And the court in Home Savings looked at the evidence, much like Chief Judge Damage, and said, it's not possible. The court there said it's impossible to tell what was done to replace the capital. And they still awarded damages, and they did so based on the fact that the tangible capital had been restored. And here we have two findings of fact from the trial court after the trial. This isn't part of the summary judgment, but two critical findings of fact. The first one, the judge said on JA-17, quote, the simple reality is that Citizens was required to mitigate by the regulators. So, and that finding of fact destroys the point made today by the government. Oh, we didn't have to shrink. We didn't have to raise capital. We have a finding of fact not challenged on appeal that we were required to by the government. And the second finding of fact on JA-18 is that, quote, Citizens actually engaged in transactions to restore its capital positions and actually incurred measurable costs in doing so. And what Home Savings says is, and LaSalle-Tallman too, that capital is fungible. If the government buys a computer for $1,000, the government can't say which taxpayers' taxes bought, funded that transaction. People don't trace money in that way. And the government is trying to set up an impossible standard where entities and plaintiffs are going to have to trace specific transactions to the breach. And in Home Savings, that argument was made, and it was specifically rejected by the court at 399 F3rd at 1353. And so, given that we're not required to trace in this way, it was entirely appropriate for Chief Judge Damage to do what he did. And if I might add, to think about what would be the consequence of a remand in this case, if there were a remand, the trial judge would not be starting with a blank slate. He would start from with his findings of fact that weren't challenged here, that we were required
to make. I don't understand the government to be asking for a remand. I understand the government to be asking for a reversal.
Yes, they are asking for that.
As I understand the government's argument, they say you're entitled to nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, they're not suggesting it should be remanded for further findings or anything like
that. Right, this is extraordinary. This court in CalFed said there are two ways to deal with the government's breach, shrink or raise capital. Here we did both. And the government's position is we get nothing. And they say that we get nothing because they say we abandoned our lost profits claim. But
now what do you say to their argument that you, in effect, conceded in the district court, in the Court of Federal Claims, that you'd have taken this action, you'd have taken the same action, even if what Congress had done would merely been to prohibit the use of subordinated debt as part of regulatory capital and had not changed the regulatory goodwill provision? You deny you said that?
No, I don't deny that as a legal matter we said that, that we reached that judgment. We do think that Home Savings and the findings of fact by the trial court ameliorate that. But the point is that in terms of did we do the exchange because of the breach? It was the government's position. I think it's important for the court to put itself in Chief Judge Damage's position. He was faced with a motion for summary judgment by us. It was the government's position in their brief at 400253 that there was a causal connection between the breach and the exchange, that one of the that there were many causes behind the exchange, and so he accepted that. Our view in the trial court was that we were entitled to lost profits. If the court had ruled in our favor on summary judgment, we would have been having a trial on lost profits. He did. He took the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, and he accepted the fact that there were multiple causes behind the exchange.
So what's your best argument to get by CalFed?
The best argument is, number one, SoCal comes after CalFed and explicitly embraces and affirms the decision that Judge Damage relied on, Judge Basquiat's, number one. Number two, CalFed itself said that, acknowledged that in Bluebonnet, the substantial factor test had been used, and said when the government's alternative causation theory doesn't make sense, then substantial factor is acceptable. And that is the case here. Their theory is that, and we've heard it today, that we did nothing. Mr. Ryan suggested today that we retained earnings. We could have retained earnings. Well, we have a finding of fact, number one, we were required to mitigate. And number two, they never suggested in the court below that we should have retained earnings. You can ask Mr. Ryan to point you to a page of a brief or oral argument where they suggested that we should have retained earnings to mitigate. That is an invented theory that was not preserved below. So I think all of those factors suggest that CalFed is not, in fact, a problem, and specifically because Home Savings and LaSalle really hammer home the point that capital is fungible, and it's just not necessary to require plaintiffs to trace specifically one capital-raising activity to another, to the breach. In Home Savings, it was agreed that it was impossible to do that. Impossible. And still, there was an award of damages. And
what the court in Cal, I'm rereading CalFed again, it says you really have to show that there were definitely established. How have you shown that it was definitely established?
Yes, we have met our burden to show that these damages were definitely established because we've shown...
Why weren't you doing it to handle the non-contractual subordinated debt?
Well, I think the way to think about it, if I may, Your Honor, is to look at were these costs, was the $18 million, does that damage, that harm, is that fairly traceable? Was it definitely established by the breach? And here what we have is finding that we were required to do this, and that this was far less expensive than an open market transaction. I mean, if they are right that we did something else, the only other choice would have been a shrink. And the trial court found that open market transactions like an issuance of preferred stock would have been far more expensive, would have been almost 10 times greater than what we did. This was a very reasonable, modest amount of damages that we agreed to accept 5.5 years ago in the hopes that we could streamline this case, because it was the government that took the position that this is what we did.
I got it. Another quote from CalFed. The Court of Federal Claims correctly rejected the substantial factor test.
Right. And, you know, there is...
Rejection of the substantial factor test is correct.
And again, there is SoCal and Indiana, Michigan Power Company, and moreover, but there was...
Are you saying we can't get it? We can't get the law right?
Is no, Your Honor, but I would say that even...
I might say that.
but even in CalFed, there was this acceptance, because in Bluebonnet, of course, Judge Foute had used the substantial factor test. That was affirmed, and the court in CalFed said, well, that's okay. It's okay to use the substantial factor test where the government's view of causation doesn't make sense. And here, they don't have a view of causation that makes sense. It's clear that the breach hurt us. It's clear it took $118 million of capital out of our pocket, and they refused to say what, in fact, we did, and instead throw up their hands and say, well, that's not our burden. You haven't proved it. And that's exactly the sort of argument that Home Savings rejected. And the decision in LaSalle Tallman from just 2 weeks ago was...
Do you take the position that even if the Court of Federal Claims applied the wrong standard when it used a substantial factor test, nevertheless, you should prevail under the correct standard?
Yes, exactly. That under Home Savings, we are in an identical position to Home under the worst view of things for us, that it's impossible to tell.
If the test has to be the motivating factor, this was the motivating factor for what you did.
Well, what I would say is that it's the damages that we incurred are traceable to it, because we have a finding that we restored our capital position, and under Home Savings, we're not required to link specific capital raising transaction to the breach.
Yeah, but in Home Savings, you didn't have a bigger chunk of debt completely unrelated to FIREA hanging out there. That's the unique thing about this case, is that there was a real big other reason for them to do what they did.
Well, actually, it's very similar, Your Honor, in the sense of in Home Savings, the Home Savings raised $900 million of capital to replace only $300 million of supervisory goodwill. So, in other words, they were raising capital for reasons wholly unrelated to the breach. And there the testimony was, we didn't think about this in terms of, well, why are we raising this $100 million? We just knew we needed to raise $900 million. We did raise $900 million. Here's how much it cost. And there was prorating. And that would be, you know, that's why the $18 million here is reasonable. In that instance, 34 cents on the dollar was awarded. Here we got half of that.
Any more questions? Any more questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Ryan?
Mr. Ryan, these computers help us these days. You know what I'm going to read from, don't you?
Probably SoCal.
Well, actually, I'm going to read from Indiana, Michigan.
Okay.
And I'm going to read where it says the damages for a breach of contract are recoverable where the breach is a substantial causal factor in the damages, the substantial factor test. And it's citing to a case, the Energy Capital Corporation case, which precedes CalFed. So you have the substantial factor test being implemented before CalFed and after CalFed.
The causation
is CalFed the one that's out of step with reality? Which one do we apply here?
You apply the decision that addressed the specific issue. Is the substantial factor test the test? Or is it the traditional Meyerly standard that's been around for 100 years? That is the only decision among all the ones Mr. Thompson cited that addressed a specific question, which is the correct test.
But so then we've applied the other test, both before and after.
You have used words.
Yes, we've used those words and apparently applied them. I mean, Judge Mayer proceeds to apply that test thereafter.
But in those cases, the issue before the court was not, was the correct test the substantial factor test or the Meyerly test?
I concede that, but the court continues to apply the incorrect test even after it has analyzed and said we're going to go with the Meyerly standard. Now, just help us out here. What are we to do?
When the issue is raised in the particular case by the government or by the plaintiff, which is the proper causation test to apply, this court must or should address, we believe, that question. But in cases, we can't appeal every single issue in a particular case. So if we feel that because the trial court applied the wrong test of causation, but would have come out even correctly under the correct test of causation, we're not necessarily going to appeal that issue. And so we believe that the case that should be followed is the one that specifically addressed the question of is it the substantial factor test or is it the traditional Meyerly test. And of course, it should be the traditional Meyerly test because Meyerly is the precedent that precedes everything else. It's from 1897.
Of course, when Judge Rader suggested that the court kept, that we kept applying the wrong test, that also suggests that perhaps the wrong test isn't the wrong test.
Well, but this court,
if we keep applying it, but I wonder about that.
But I can cite a dozen cases in which this court has applied the Meyerly test, including CalFed, including the Olin and Jones case that we just cited, including the First Heights case, which is a recent case from this court.
Well, so, you're basically saying to us, whatever the test is, we should now make it clear exactly what it is?
And I think this court should make it clear, but I think it doesn't really need to make it any more clear.
Well, you say we already have made it clear.
Yes, in CalFed.
Even though it seems as though we're not applying what we made clear.
It could be argued that way, perhaps, but the issue is squarely addressed.
I commend both counsel for dancing around the court's inadequacies.
the bottom line is the issue was squarely addressed. In none of the cases cited by Mr. Thompson was the court addressing the issue. Is it substantial factor or is it the traditional Meyerly direct and proximate test? But again, under any test, given the court's decision and given the court's, given the plaintiff's statements and their witnesses' statements that they would have undertaken this activity even in the absence of the breach, under either test, the trial court's decision should be reversed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Thompson, this is taken under submission.